though.
Man, I like that. That is such a good song. As we mentioned before, ooh, look at, it's me. I can see myself, which is amazingly distracting. Okay. Can everybody hear me? I can't hear myself. Good. Okay. Welcome, everybody. Wow, we have a bunch of new people in here. How cool is this? My name is Rabbi Davidzach, and welcome to class. This is the Virtual Yeshiva and the Noah chat room. Wow, Maccabi 613. How cool is that? Wow, you guys are the greatest Knicks. Anyway, I'm here to teach for 2 hours. And I'm not one of those people who just kind of sit here and yak my brains out for 2 hours. If you have a question about last week's Torah portion, this week's Torah portion, these are kind of interesting ones. 21 people already. Yeah, buddy. In the ultimate Maccabee. Cool. So if anybody has a question, please ask. If you're embarrassed to put your question up in front of everybody else, then you can take somebody with a black name, one of the moderators in here. What's the topic? The Divine Code. No. The Divine Code is the seven laws of Noah. And this week we are on the prohibition of blasphemy. Yeah, it's kind of a fun class. If you don't know the seven laws, they're kind of interesting. Is it about Noahides? No, it's about the seven laws, and these seven laws were around prior to Sinai, so they're kind of interesting to study in that all the footnotes come out of Torah and some of the other writings. So stick around. It's Pat Brockman. I haven't seen that name in about a month. Yeah, how to be righteous Gentiles. Exactly. Thought maybe you moved away or something, Pat. Haven't seen you in about a month. So anyway, if you do have a question, comment, or complaint, either way, please, by all means, ask. Last week's Torah portion was a double Torah portion. We discussed some what I thought was a very interesting area was the red heifer. There was also Parsha Balak, which I don't know how many of you know this, but the Balak and Bilam, the person who was asked to curse the children of Israel, he was one of Pharaoh's advisors who made the suggestion that we were enslaved. So it's a very interesting further story about the man. And anybody that want to take a wild guess on what was going on while he was building his altars and sacrificing his animals and instead of cursing us, praised us? How beautiful are your tents, O Jacob, that instead of cursing us, that's what he said. Anyone want to take a guess on what was going on? Bonnie is on the phone now. Oh. No, what was going on is this week's Torah portion. Okay? So if you have read a little bit about this week's Torah portion, what was going on in Balak, what was happening in Parsha Pinchas was happening down in the settlement of below, so to speak, which we will get to. So the first 90 minutes of class is me teaching out of this book. And again, if you don't have this book, I don't know, is volume 2 of this out yet, Oki? They told me it would be out in Tammuz, and we're in the month of Tammuz. Not yet. It's due out this month. So we're going through this book, and when we're done, Stone Edition Chumash. And so, as I have mentioned before, there are three books that I strongly recommend. I know there's some other classes out there in the world who says you need, you know, go out and spend $10,000 on a set of books for this class. Well, guess what? What I'm asking everybody in here to do, if you want to get a set of books for this class, 3 books for 2 years. The Divine Code, you're a bookmaker, how cool is that? Get the Divine Code, the Bnei Noach prayer book, Service of the Heart, and the Stone Edition, Chumash, which if I'm not mistaken, my wife will, 4 books when volume 2 is out, wow. Oh, well, there we go, see? My wife put up what we feel that you'll need to get a good solid start. An interesting conversation came up during the week. That song that we play, hello Nancy, I didn't see Nancy come in. The song that we play before class and we play at the end of class. 3 books, 2 volumes equals 4 books. Ooh, higher math. 4 books when volume 2 is out. I'm not sure I understand the math, but anyway, I'm, you know, that higher math just throws me. Oh, 2 volumes. Oh, so volume 1, then volume 2, and that's all you need, right? I'm a little bit slow in the uptake this evening. Beautiful. Okay, again, any questions? Rabbi needs a drink. Ta-da! Arrowhead. I'm get my Johnny Bench later, but I've decided some nice cold water would be really good. Not yet. Told my wife I think I want to start off a little bit of water. It's been hot out here, so a little bit of water is good. Okay, no questions. I'm going to start in. No. No, we have mystery juice. We have plenty of mystery juice. My Arnold Palmer, as my wife calls it, my Johnny Bench, we have plenty of that. My wife keeps me well-stocked in lemonade and iced tea. So for those of you who don't know what a Johnny Bench is, what my wife calls it, which is the original name was an Arnold Palmer. An Arnold Palmer is, depending on the amounts that you personally prefer, it is a mixture of very nice and very good iced tea with lemonade. And that's called an Arnold Palmer, which I'm kind of partial to those. Also, as I was saying before I distracted myself, very interesting email came in. You know that song we play in the beginning and the end? That's a Breslover song. That guy, Adi Ron, is a Breslover. And there was an email sent to me by the Breslovers asking how they can help, which I was really impressed. That is, I sent them an email back and looking forward to hearing from them. And if Breslovers want to help us, and you've never come in contact with them, they are amazingly spiritual people. They really are. Yeah, we got his CDs from Breslover.com. So Breslovers are just wonderfully spiritual people. So hopefully this week I'll hear back from them and see what kind of ways they can help us. I mean, even if a guy comes in here, Breslover comes in here and decides he wants to sing for an hour, I mean, I'm good to go. Oh, look, hey, my pink arrow died. I need another pink arrow. Thank you. I got a whole bunch of colored arrows there. Okay, and finally, for those of you that are new, if you don't have fun in this class, it's not my fault. Yeah, I did not have the laugh. There was no picture last week. Okay, get started. I am on page 262, the Prohibition of Blasphemy, Chapter 1. As I mentioned last week, I wanted to start this chapter over. It's a very interesting chapter. We just finished up the section on idolatry, and the section on idolatry was huge. I mean, in the book it was, you know, where am I? That much, which is quite a bit. So So anyway, no questions. Like I said, if you do have a question, talk to a moderator, post it up here. I would be honored to answer it. All right. Gentiles, now I either call it righteous Gentiles, B'nai Noach, etc. Gentiles are warned against blessing God's name. The term is euphemistic. This means cursing God's name. So it is a huge sin to blaspheme the Almighty. That's a huge sin. They are liable for this. Adam, the first person, was warned about this, as it says in Genesis 2:16, and the Lord commanded upon Adam. This means that God commanded his divinity and authority upon Adam. The three meanings of this statement are as follows. Oh, yeah, page 262. I am God. Do not exchange me for another God, this being the prohibition of idolatry. I am God. Do not curse me, this being the prohibition of blasphemy. I am God. The fear of me shall be upon you, this being the obligation to fear God. Fearing God is part of the general commandment to guard oneself against committing blasphemy. And as we said last week, the idea of fearing God is not, you know, a kid kind of, whoa, my little doggy coming in saying hello. It's not cowering in the corner fear of God. And we've mentioned this time and again, and for those of you that are new, I'll go over this again. The first two commandments of the Big Ten are to love God and to fear God. And to love God is an absolute love of our divine parent. And the fear is not a cowering in the corner, afraid to breathe fear. It's not wanting to do an avera, where avera is a sin, and disappointing the parent. You know that look that you would get as a kid on mom and dad's face? That look when you got caught with your hand in the cookie jar or something like that? And they gave you that look that you just didn't want to see because it was that parent that was very disappointed. That level is fear. Is there a benefit for a Jew to be familiar with the Noahide laws? Absolutely. Sephardic Maccabee 6:13. What should I call you? 6:13? In which ways? Well, you know something, Sephardic Maccabee 6:13? That's a big name. You know, Sephardic, there are people out there that you run into. Okay, I'll call you Maccabee. There are people that you run into out in the world that are either searching or have a question. And what I do is I find somebody who is not Jewish, and some people either are questioning or are searching, I tell them about these laws. And as a Jew, it is my responsibility, and as Jews, it is our responsibility to share an explanation of these laws with the B'nai Noach. There are really only two groups that are going to be around in the time of the Moshiach, Jews and B'nai Noach. Christianity and all of those teaching is creating a new religion. So in that, putting aside all the other stuff about Christianity, and I mean, there is a ton of the stuff out there that I don't get and I don't really want to know. They will be the first ones judged according to the Gemara. Then, of course, we have the Muslims and all these other people out there that will be judged. Because, again, Islam has a belief in one God, which isn't a problem, but the problem with it is a faith that was established later. And the difficulty with that is you're not allowed to establish a new religion or take on other commandments, etc. And so, therefore, it is our job to share this with people who ask. Okay, hopefully that answers your questions, Fardik, or Maccabee, or 6:13. Okay? So, the bottom line is to know these is important because righteous Gentiles, or Gentiles out there that are looking for something other than the, for lack of a better term, the situation that they're in, they come to us and ask questions. And we really do have a responsibility to have answers, because the time of the Mashiach is when righteous Gentiles will be living with us. And that's pretty important. That's very important. Hey, Bob. Okay, did I answer your question, Maccabee? Good. Okay. Now, wait a minute, Yisro. Both. Maccabee, both. Absolutely both. Because it says in Torah, the strangers that were living amongst us, those are the righteous Gentiles. Those are the ones who took on the... There will be no conversions at the time of Mashiach. That is very true. But Sephardic, if you take a look in Torah, the strangers that dwelt with us in the land followed the laws of Noah, and those people who lived with us were righteous Gentiles. And they had 7 laws to follow. 1 law, then 6 laws, now 7. Okay? Okay? Beautiful. Okay, beautiful. See, like something like this, if you do have a question, something comes up, you need to make a comment. I don't mind as long as we stay on topic. I really don't mind what direction you go in, because I'm here for you. So if you do have a question, don't be shy. And I do know that, hey, Devorah is here. I do know that in other faiths, once somebody is teaching, preaching, or whatever they called it, you were always taught to kind of sit back and not say a word. Well, it's a little bit different now that you're a B'nai Noach. Now you didn't see me last week. Now that you're B'nai Noach, is to ask questions. Because if you are responsible, which you are, for 7 laws, and ignorance of the law is no excuse once you start studying these, and you do have a question, it's a mistake not to ask. Okay? All right, I'm moving on. Oh, we still have to send her that message about the homeschooler. I'll get to that. I apologize. I think the person's in here who asked me that question 2 weeks ago, and with me, I didn't get back to it yet. We will. All right. This prohibition, I'm again, bottom of 262, this prohibition was again commanded explicitly in the Torah regarding Gentiles, as it says, any man who blasphemes his God shall bear his sin, and one who pronounces blasphemously God's name shall be put to death by a court. Thus Moses received and transmitted additional details and clarifications about this Noahide prohibition. All right, and we went over this. This was fun last week. I might do a little drawing on this and pop my whiteboard up here. Okay. And number 2, page 263. What is the definition of pronounces blasphemously God's name? In the above cited verse, which refers to the explicit name of God. The explicit name of God is either the tetragrammaton, which is the yud and the hay and the vav and the hay, which is few folks, this yud. If you're on your whiteboard, you can see what I'm doing. Okay? Or you know how hard it is to write like this? Okay, that's the four-letter name of God, and it's over there on the whiteboard. Okay. Or the name Adoshem, which means Lord in Hebrew, and is essentially the same, or the sense of supreme rulership. Now, one thing that is really important, if you look in the book, it has a word. This is the word. I've got to get a little thinner line on here. It has this word. How come this is in purple? Okay, this right here. Hopefully everybody's on the whiteboard. You see that little hyphen in there? What we don't do is we don't, in just a discussion like this, pronounce God's name. First of all, the Yud and the Hey and the Vav and the Hey, which I've heard some people refer to it as Havaya, that is the name of God that was pronounced one time a year. And as we have no temple, we do not know how to pronounce this. I've seen in other Bibles and other people's hands, they have a strange pronunciation for this. And there is no pronunciation. This pronunciation is Hashem, means the name. Okay? So instead of saying this word, I would say Adoshem. Okay? And instead of saying this, I would say Shakai. Okay? So if I'm using these words, please don't let it throw you off, because it is very important that if you're using one of God's names, it's not used in vain, hence one of the Big Ten. Okay? It's my honor, really. Every time, those of you who don't know it, I come in here, and every time I teach class, people are so pleased, and the owners of this room are so pleased, I get 100% raise in pay. So I want to thank everybody else for coming in here, because it just adds another zero to all the zeros I get. No, these 2 hours are a labor of love. Honestly, they're a labor of love. Does this hold for any of the 72 names? Yes. Well, there are, Larry, a couple of names of God that we use, and sometimes daily. In fact, when I came into this room, let me erase this. In Hebrew, this word here, and trust me, this is hard to write on one of these. This word here is the name of God. It means hello, it means goodbye, it means peace. It's also a name of God. So in that one, you would not say it a little bit differently. You would say it the way it is. But if you're having a discussion and you're talking about the four-letter name of God, also referred to as a tetragrammaton, and you see the word Hashem, usually that is the... They can say... I had to move your face, Rabbi, to see the shin. Oh, move my face this way. They can say Ein Sof, they can say Or Ein Sof, but unless you understand Kabbalah, you wouldn't understand any of that or what that meant. And this is not a Kabbalah class. So Ein Sof is the infinite, Or Ein Sof is the infinite light. Okay, well, we got to get a full house in here. How cool is that? All right, any questions? Please understand that I am not expecting all of you to grasp this right away. And if you do not understand what I am saying, you got to ask. I am a school teacher by trade, and also as a parent. It takes 80 times for somebody to tell you something for it to stick in the gray matter. And so if it doesn't stick the first 20 or 30 times, you're a little bit short. So you've heard your mother say, I've told you once, I've told you 100 times. Well, you know something, Mom? It's pretty darn close, because it takes 80 times of hearing the same thing to make a mark in the gray matter. And so if you have a question, even if I have answered it once before, either somebody new in here doesn't know it, or you need to hear it again, I don't mind. So please don't be shy when you ask a question. And there's no such thing as a dumb question. I don't believe in dumb questions. The dumb question, I suppose, is the one you don't ask. Okay. All right. the capital sin of blasphemy. And blasphemy is a capital sin. The capital sin of blasphemy is committed if a person clearly requests by his mouth a curse from God using the explicit name. That's blasphemy. And if you notice, we have something, human beings have something in this world, being the top of the food chain, we have something very unique that no other creature has. We have the faculty of speech. And if you notice in these other classes over the last, 8 or 9 months, however long we've been doing this, the faculty of speech comes up in Lashon Hora, gossip, etc., we've been talking about. We have a faculty of speech that can either do great good or tremendous harm. My favorite and my biggest hero as far as the Rebbeim go over the centuries is a little rabbi by the name of Chofetz Chaim. He was a gentle, quiet, very slow of speech person. They thought he was had some difficulties because his speech was so deliberate, and he thought about each word before it left his mouth that people thought he was slow. But the Chofetz Chaim of blessed memory, he died in 1933. And was an author of many books, including Mishnah Berurah, was so deliberate in his speech that he literally, thank you, that he literally chose each word he spoke very, very, very carefully. So the power and the faculty of speech, what it says in here, something coming out of your mouth, is a pretty important, it's a pretty important comment. How? By invoking one of the holy names of God or one of his attributive names, against the explicit name, that is to say, that God, as he is called by one of his names, should do such and such a harm to himself, as he is called by the explicit name. So if you are taking one of God's names and wishing God ill and invoking his name, that's a capital crime. Whew, wow. Topic three, which we'll get into. Yes. Yes. Bob, yes. One is liable if this is stated in a way, as an example. Here's an example. May Yossi strike Yossi. The common nickname Yossi is substituted as a euphemism to avoid explaining this with the actual explicit name of God in such a negative context. Using the euphemistic name Yossi does not carry any liability. Equally forbidden are blaspheming in a way of may Yossi curse Yossi, or may the merciful one or compassionate one, etc., curse Yossi. That is to say, using an attributive name along with one of the expressions of the explicit name. This obviously applies if one curse God's explicit name with the same name, such as Adoshem with Adoshem. Okay? So anybody who is that insane to do that, get what they deserve. That is a death sentence. And we don't have a Sanhedrin anymore, so it can't be done by that, so it gets to be done by the hand of heaven, which is a topic of another discussion one of these days we'll have to get into. Death by heaven is a very, very interesting discussion. We'll get to it one of these days. Okay, 264. Equally forbidden are blaspheming the way of may Yossi curse Yossi, or may the merciful one or compassionate one, etc., curse Yossi. All right. What is considered a holy name other than the explicit name, and what is considered an attributive name? It's a little more than divine retribution. It's separation from heaven. It's death by the hand of heaven. The holy names of God, specifically in Hebrew, are those that are forbidden to be erased after they are written down in the permanent fashion. In addition to the explicit name, Adoshem, these names are Kel, Elohim, Elokai, Shekai, Tzvaos, Ihiya, Ehya, as well as any variant of Elohim. All of these have the same holiness as the name Elohim. So you cannot say any of those out of context, as in out of prayer or study. No, no. The attributive names are the Merciful One, the Compassionate One, the Creator, and the like, and any other attributive name, including a name in any language other than Hebrew, by which a person clearly is referring to God, who is the creator of the universe. Just as well as people don't know how to pronounce the divine names then. Yes. But you know something, Francis? Here's something that I apologize, everybody, but I go off on this almost every time it comes up. I go off on a little tangent. There are people in other faiths, and I've run into this over the last 30, 40 years, and what people do in other faiths is they read the Hebrew Bible and they take a look at some mispronunciations of God's name and they start throwing those names around willy-nilly. So they're talking and they're tossing out this name of God in their discussion and their hands are up in the air and they're throwing out that name of God, and somebody who's sick, they toss out this name of God and all that. You know what the problem with that is? There is a very nurturing side of God. There is referred to as the home or the creative side of God, which if you look on a mezuzah, that letter that kind of looks like this, there's a shin on it, on your mezuzah. That's Shekai. That's one of the names of God. That is the home protective level. That's the creative, procreative side of God. And if you have a loved one or a family member that is very, very ill, the last thing you want to do is to invoke, because you don't understand the names of them, the last thing you want to do is invoke the judgment side of God. It's, Devorah, there's so much more than that. It's beyond ignorance. These people are doing themselves and their family a tremendous amount of harm. Let's suppose, God forbid, let's suppose you got a loved one who's very sick. And you're praying and you're asking God for some help. The last thing you want to do is, the last thing you want to do is to bring down to this person who is very, very ill the judgment side of God. You know, you don't want somebody to take your loved one who you want to get well, indeed the nurturing side of God, and invoke the judgment side of God. That's not a real smart thing to do. Yet I hear it over and over and over. We shut our TV off 3 years ago, and there's some goofy TV channels out there on cable that have these people, and they're just coming out with all of these names. I invoke God on Gentile cities sometimes. I don't understand what that means. Oh, just joking. Isn't judgment a real part of Judaism? Oh, yeah, I got you. Not a problem, Maccabee. Yes. But, Devorah, God created this world. It says in Torah, the first phrase in Torah, Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim v'et ha'aretz. God created, invented the concept of creation, then God. We say in the English, God. In the Hebrew, it's Elohim. El Elohi is God and the witnesses to creation, which were the heavenly court. God created this physical world with a sense of judgment, right and wrong, black and white, male and female, up and down, in and out. There is balance in this world, okay? So if you have the judgment side, as in the father with his hands on his hips, looking down at his kid, oh, you blew it, and dad is going to adjudicate whatever your punishment is, and suppose he gives you a little pachintuchus, as a kid, who do you run to? You run to mom. Mom's down there, you know, come to mommy, I'll make you feel better and all that. Or you fall down, you scrape your knee, you run to mom. You don't run to dad. If you're out running down the sidewalk and you fall down on your little tuchus and you scrape your palms and your elbows and stuff and you come running in, you're not going to go running to dad. Dad's going to sit there with his hands on his hips and go, suck it up, kid, get out and play. Don't get too dirty. Your mom will get mad at you. Okay? This is what the masculine side, walk it off, dad says. There you go. Okay? That is a male attribute. The female attribute of God, the nurturing side of God, the side of God, the divine presence is the side that took us under its wings for 40 years and took care of us. It's the side of God. Get me started on that one, Devorah. There's a really, my wife and I talk about that all the time. There is a side of God that is clearly a nurturing side, and that has a feminine, a female attribute. Okay? That was a fun tangent. Bina's V. Gates. Take a drink? Yes, dear. The boss said take a drink. Now, Mac, it's for Zorachat. I like the Bina. That's kind of cool. Female name. Bruchta Milchalav Shahak Kolonie Bidvro. Someone say amen. And I looked that up. You know something? Thank you. It's neat because I read something actually yesterday. And this question comes up time and again. Let's suppose you're on the phone talking to somebody and somebody does a bracha. Should you say amen? I don't know. I'm not in the same room as the person. I don't know what they're doing. So, and the question came up, are they really saying a blessing? Are they pulling your leg? Whatever. But what it says is you have a choice of yes, of saying amen, or not saying amen when you hear a bracha. So, you don't necessarily have to. So, when I drink water, that's a shahakol blessing. I bet it's Deborah. What do you bet? Nathan? Oh, she's probably trying to get a whole call. Oh, go answer. Okay. Well, we've got a room full of people in here. Okay, did that answer your question about male-female attributes, the dangers of people invoking a side of God that they should not be invoking? And I've told my Gentile friends for the last 30 years, be careful what you're asking for. Be careful. And a lot of times they just blow me off. But, oh well. It's between them and their maker. Yeah. Okay, we're making good time tonight. And Chesed won't be here. He's got a great-grandchild coming in at the airport, so he told me he won't be here. All right. Number three, I'm on page 265. Again, if you don't have the book, it's really a good, it's not very expensive. I think the book's $18 or something like that. Question, yes, ma'am. I'll be listening. Is it proper to pray out in public? Of course, why not? Yeah, why not? Why not? Now, I got an idea with Mac. I was told not to. Okay, let's suppose the Vorla. Let's suppose you're out having coffee somewhere. Starbucks, black coffee at Starbucks is kosher. You have coffee. You bring your own little packet of coloring, whatever it is. And you're going to drink, have a sip of your coffee, and you do the Bracha Shehakol. That's praying out loud. Let's suppose you're in a college class. You know how many times I've prayed in college classes before I've taken tests? A lot. You don't go out in public on top of a mountain, put on your tallis and tefillin and daven. That's really something you shouldn't do. Yeah, pray in advance, that's good. But can you say a bracha? A child at our rally prayed kind of chanted. It was told it was not really proper. Well, here's one, and my wife is sitting here. You can ask her. I have been in airports. And when we were coming back from New York once upon a time, we were in the airport in New York, and we had to get there. We had like a 6 a.m. flight out. So we had to get there at like a 3:45 in the morning. Hey, look what I found. A captain. I didn't know that. How cool is that? So anyway, I was at the airport. I've done this many times, and you might have seen it a few times. I was at an airport. It was, I don't know, it was time for Shacharit in the morning. And I knew if I was going to get on the airplane, I didn't want to go on there. The airplane was full, blah, blah, blah. So I go off in a corner of the airline terminal. I hate the term terminal because that terminal and flight doesn't necessarily go hand in hand. I went off in what I thought was a corner, not in the middle of the room, but kind of off to the side. I put on my tallis, I put on my tefillin, and I'm, you know, shackling my brains out. Shackling is the swaying that we do when we pray. Shackling. So I'm shackling my brains out. And I'm praying in this, and I get done after doing, you know, my 90 minutes of praying, etc. And I turn around, and there's 4 or 5 people behind me, all doing the same thing, watching what I'm doing. And they got their tefillin on, they got their tallis on. There's a couple kids there, and they kind of looked at me, and I turn around, there's a big old gray beard and everything. I turn around and smile at them, and we pack our stuff up and get ready to get on the airplane. So can you pray in public? Yes. It is not a sin to pray in public. But you're not supposed to be like out on the 50-yard line at a football game, you know, davening, because one difficulty, Devorah, is being interrupted in the middle of prayer. If you're in a portion of the prayer you're not supposed to, you're not supposed to stop. The difference between what Christians do, Maccabee, and what we do is like night and day. We have a set prayer consisting of preliminary davening, Psukei Dezimra, Kriya Shema, and the Amida in the end. I guess that's what I thought. Maybe it seems like it's for attention. Not necessarily. Okay? Did I answer your question, Devorah? You're more than welcome. I'm merely saying don't emulate Christians in how they seek attention. Then again, where I live, if you watch me walking down the street with my big black hat and all that, I do have a tendency to stand out like a sore thumb. That's because I'm tall and there's not many of us in this town I live in, which will hopefully change one day soon. Thank you. Oh, no. My wife and I want to move to a very large, a much bigger Jewish community. And we're trying to put our little ducks in a row to do that, but those little ducks keep running around, so we can't get them quite in the row we want them to get them in. You want to make Aliyah? Ooh, nice. There's a 15% jump in people heading off to Israel. Aflac. What are you... Maccabee, wow. Nice. Well, keep in touch with me. Let me know how that goes. Are you going to do Nefesh B'Nefesh? Is that how you're going to go, Nefesh B'Nefesh? Devorah? That seems to be the only way. Yeah, that's the only way to go. Soul by soul, Nefesh B'Nefesh. Okay, 4. One who, I know. Get a drink of water. Yes, dear. Wow. Yummy. Sure, go ahead. Look before you leap. Sure, go ahead. Who is it? Go ahead, Devorah. Or did you already make it? Look up Arut Sheva. Yeah, what does it say? Oh, nice. Okay. If you want to post the link in here, you're more than welcome. Just go look it up, highlight, copy the link, and put it in the little typing area, and yeah. Okay. Nice. Yeah, post the link. Devorah, post the link. All right, back to class. Night. All right. One who blasphemes and then regrets his words and retracts them even immediately is still liable for capital punishment from a base deen if he sinned by cursing God's explicit names as it is proven by valid testimony. Here's something that's really important to understand. Once you take a thought, turn it into a word, and it leaves your mouth, you can't take it back. And so if you do something and you may say something that you regret and try and take it back, there's a story that I tell my wife periodically. She kind of likes this story. There is this man in town who had heard some disparaging thing about the new rabbi that had just joined the shul. And this person just was relentless. And he told everybody how hideous this rabbi was, and he went on and on and on. This guy was a mover and a shaker in the community, and he spread, and he told people about this rabbi, and this rabbi that. It made it very difficult for the rabbi, very, very difficult. Well, lo and behold, one day he found out that he was wrong. He was dead wrong. And what did he do? He immediately went to the rabbi's house, knocked on the door, and apologized. He says, here's what I have done. I do apologize with every fiber of my being. Everything that I said, I found out it was wrong, and please forgive me. And the rabbi says, you want me to forgive you? The guy says, yes. He says, rabbi says, do you own a feather pillow? The person thought, huh? Rabbi says, do you own a feather pillow? He says, yes. Rabbi says, go home and get it, bring it back. So he comes back a little while with his feather pillow, and the rabbi says, cut it open. Unusual request, but he wants the rabbi to forgive him. Takes his knife and he slices that dude open. Rabbi takes it and shakes it, and there are feathers everywhere. And the rabbi said to him, you want me to forgive you? Pick up all the feathers. Needless to say, once it leaves your mouth, what you say, good, bad, or ugly, you can't take it back. You can apologize, you can do teshuvah, but you can't take it back. The damage that you've done with what you have said has been done. And so when I was a very little kid, my mother used to tell me that I needed... My mother used to tell me that I needed to put my mind in gear before I put my mouth in motion. And this is saying the same thing. If you say something, if in a fit of stupidity, you decide to blaspheme in front of witnesses, God forbid. You decide to do that, and it's in front of witnesses, you're done. You're done. You can't take that back. And especially where it says in here, it is proven by valid testimony. This mitzvah applies to Jews. It applies to Gentiles too. Blasphemy is blasphemy, period. Anyone who curses the explicit name by invoking against it a name of God in any language, whether with a translated name of God or his attributes, and likewise the wording of the curse may be in any language, is liable for a capital sin. If the words of the language he used are clearly calling on God to harm the explicit name, he's liable according to the definition of blasphemy. In particular, one is not liable unless he pronounces the object of the curse in correct Hebrew as Yudke Vavke or Adoshem. However, a person translates this object of the curse into another language, he's exempt from punishment. What's the question? Do B'nai Noach need to, in the very least? I don't understand your question. The gates. We'll come back Shabbos morning? That's cool. We'll feed him lunch. How cool is that? I know. Yes. Okay, finish it up. Yes, two witnesses for capital punishment, yes. Yeah, it's always two witnesses. If it's a capital crime, it's two witnesses. Well, Pat left. See, he leaves around 7 o'clock. Okay. If someone curses God in the name of idolatry, he is not to be judged or punished by a base deen, but he's still committing a grave sin for which he will be punished by heaven. A zealot who hears someone blaspheming by saying, "May such and such an idol strike Yossi," has permission from God to strike down the blasphemer on the spot and should not be punished for doing so. But if that does not happen and this blasphemer is brought before the court, he is not liable for capital punishment. Laws of worshiping of stars in the Rambam. That's interesting. You hear somebody blaspheme, you strike them. Wow. I don't get the opportunity to do that ever. But then again, that's a good thing. A zealot is only given this permission to strike down a blasphemer at the time he hears the blasphemy being uttered. So, if you hear rumor that somebody has done that, you can't go over there and smack them. That would be a bad idea. A zealot is only given this permission to strike down a blasphemer at the time he hears the blasphemy being uttered, and only if he hears the blasphemy himself. However, if he heard from others that a person blasphemed, or if he waits a short period of time after the transgression was committed, he has no permission to kill the blasphemer. If you hear a Christian do this, smack them, and smack them hard, real hard. I don't understand. It's like a stream of thought. It's kind of interesting. Seven. Oh, one of them when they try to say the name of Hashem. That's not really blasphemy. That's not really blasphemy, but, you know, I don't smack them if they started doing that. I just kind of... They're kind of Darwin winners, if you understand what a Darwin winner is, a Maccabee. Because if somebody wants to go invoke the judgment name of God and they're using it willy-nilly, dude, it's on them. They just... I wouldn't say they're losers. That Darwin winners are Darwin winners. It's like wanting to rob the neighborhood 7-Eleven and calling the cops and asking them to meet you there because you're going to go rob a store. You know, So these people who are willy-nilly using these names, I mean, I look at them and just say, oh, well. Because they are using something and playing with something they don't understand. They think they understand, but they don't understand. Eight. Okay. All the above explains when one would be liable in a court of law. However, it is obvious that it is always forbidden to curse God in any other way, since that is included in the general sense of blasphemous speech. And one who does so has committed a grave sin that is punishable by the heavenly court. As it says, any man who will blaspheme his God shall bear his sin. I want to smack Benny Hinn. That's that guy with the hairdo that kind of goes like this, huh? He's got like a bad comb over or something like that. He's got the coolest comb over I've ever seen. That guy, oh man. I don't know what language he speaks or where that guy's from, but he's a crack up. Palestinian Elvis. Okay, I'm going back to work here before I get myself in trouble by saying something. That, what? This guy's comparing Benny Hinn to a Palestinian Elvis. I thought that was pretty funny. See? I thought that was kind of a crack up. Uh-oh. Yes, dear. Now look what you did, Maccabee. You got me in trouble with my wife, dude. Okay, I'm going back to work. Man. Yes, dear. Take a drink of water. Yes, dear. Uh-oh. Maccabee, you're going to get me in trouble, dude. What? I'm not, thank God. Okay. How come I'm in purple and you're in blue? Oh, because I was on that computer last week. Ah, okay. You'll go pink, I'll go blue. Hang on a second, I got blue on here. Ah, much better. Okay. Back to work. Nine. Oh, very good. Likewise, it's forbidden for one to write words of blasphemy or other insults towards God. I can't even believe people would think of doing this. I can pick colors. I can, but I'm not going to tell you how, dude. Got to figure that one out. Oh, God, he's in green. All right. Man, we're zipping along here. I think I'll get through chapter 3 if I move a little bit faster and stop playing as much. What? Okay, I'm going to use this little pink arrow again and put it at the end of the chapter. That's what I want to get to. Hey, Maccabee, pick another color, man. That kind of looks like split pea soup. Kind of, yeah. All right, four. Likewise, any mention of God's name is not... Excuse me. Likewise, any mention of God's name for not is forbidden. N-A-U-G-H-T. since this disgraces the honor of God, and one receives punishment from heaven for this. Regarding this, it is written, you shall not take the name of God in vain. God will not hold guiltless one who takes his name in vain. Meaning that a person remains guilty of his sin until he is punished by heaven for profaning God's name. It is also said to fear the honorable and awesome name, since from the obligation of fearing God, it is prohibited to mention his name for naught, N-A-U-G-H-T. This applies specifically to the holy names specified for him, which may not be erased, listed in topic above. Now, if you... I skipped a page? I didn't skip a page. Nope, I did that. I did? No, I did. Uh-oh. Did I skip 268? Sorry. Okay, I'm on 268. Sorry. Oh, no! The rabbi's human. Ah! Must be a Democrat. Oh, you guys crack me up. Okay, I apologize. How dare you act like a human? Thank you for correcting me. I mean, I do know there's a lot of organizations out there that if the person who is teaching the class does something, everybody goes whisper, 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 but no one does anything about it. But the nice thing about this class is if I skip a page, you guys have put the brakes on me. I like that picture of me right there, Oki. You guys have put the brakes on me and send me back. I do apologize. Chapter 2. Prohibition of blasphemy, obligations to revere and fear God. And yes, I did skip a page, and I do apologize. Gentiles are commanded to fear and honor God. This is included in the Torah prohibition of blasphemy, as God commanded Noah, I am God, do not curse me. I could have sworn I did this. Okay. Hang on a second. I guess it was. You were going gaga. I skipped a page. It was obvious that the primary reason for the prohibition of blasphemy is the obligation to honor and fear God. Thus, in the explanation of the verse, you shall not curse God, the Hebrew word for curse has the same root as the term for disgrace. And this is some of the beauty of Hebrew. You say the word curse, it has the same root as disgrace. There's a substitution thing that you can do in Hebrew with letters, numerical values, etc. From this it can be understood that any action that causes a desecration of God's name and the opposite of bringing honor to God's name is forbidden. And this is the reason why, if you notice up here on the whiteboard, I do not write out God's name. There, it looks just like me, doesn't it? Okay. What are the Atbash codes? Okay. Number 2. One who swears falsely in God's name also desecrates his name, as it says, you shall not swear in my name falsely and desecrate the name of God, I am God. For by doing so, one denies the truth of one whose name he swears by. Since he effectively is saying that just as his words are false, so is the existence of God false. Who's that? I'll have to call him later. It is likewise forbidden to lie or falsely deny that he has promised or made an oath. Furthermore, one who changes his word is considered as if he serves idols. It is even forbidden to swear in God's name in vain. That is to say, to swear about something for which an oath is unnecessary, as will be explained in topic 312. That's going to be interesting. Since it is a disgrace to honor since it is a disgrace to the honor of his name to mention and swear by his name in vain. Whether one swears by one of the names of God or by one of his attributive names, it is the same as long as he clearly intends to mention God by this. For example, one who swears by the one whose name is the compassionate or by the one whose name is the merciful and the like, whether in Hebrew or in any way these attributive names are translated in other languages, this is considered a vow in God's name. Does that also include actions that might be considered blasphemous, that is, actions that don't bring honor to Hashem? That wouldn't call that blasphemy. I would just call that a sin. That is a very, very, very broad question, Larry. But is blasphemy oral? What we're discussing right now is referring to blasphemy, usually from an oral discussion. Yeah, the idea of actions that don't bring honor are much different than speaking, because the reason is the faculty of speech is a very powerful faculty. And if you add that in, this power of speech with actions, you have a hornet's nest you don't want to go, you don't want to enter into. Okay? All right. Whether one swears by one of the names of God or by one of his attributive names, I did that already. Okay. Page 270. That's where I think I ended up before starting. I was on a roll, that's for sure. Okay, likewise, any mention of God's name for naught is forbidden. That's where I was once upon a time before you guys called me back. Since this disgraces the honor of God, and one receives punishment from heaven for this, regarding this it is written, you shall not take the name of God in vain. God will not hold guiltless one who takes his name in vain, meaning that a person remains guilty of this sin until he's punished by heaven for profaning God's name. It is also said to fear the honorable and awesome name. Since from the obligation of fearing God, it is prohibited to mention his name for naught. You don't want to go there. This applies specifically to the holy names specified for him, and even his names in other languages, but there is no prohibition of mentioning God's attributive names in vain, such as compassionate, merciful, or other shared names, etc. So that's not blasphemy. Okay. Hey, Jim. Therefore, one who erred and mentioned God's name for no reason should immediately praise and give honor to him in order that the mentioning of his name should not be in vain. For example, if one said God, he should immediately say, blessed be he forever, or he who is great and very exalted. Again, the long and the short of this is when you're talking about the Creator, you're talking about God, you're talking about the head of the heavenly court, you're talking about the divine presence, be very cognizant of what you're saying. That's why you'll hear most Jews refer to God not as God, but as Hashem. That is very, very simple. So vain in this sense doesn't mean vanity, in that it has to do with the attitude that it won't benefit. MJS, I do believe, so vain, what you're doing is taking the name in vain, and what it does not mean vanity at all. What it means is, anybody got dictionary.com up? The word vain is using it, I think the best slang term I've heard is willy-nilly. I use that quite a bit. If you're taking the name in vain, you're using it in a context it should not be used. And I don't know if it has so much to do with the attitude that it won't benefit. I think that's a different thought. Okay? I believe that's true. But if you want to go to dictionary.com and look up the word vain, it's taking it and using the name in a way it should not be used. It means arrogant, boastful, conceited, what else? Egocentric, haughty, inflated. So you don't want to use God's name in an arrogant, egotistic manner, especially using the name to curse that same name. That's blasphemy, and you don't want to go there. So like I said, if you're at all concerned that you might be heading into a gray area, just say Hashem. That's it. It's very simple. Because Hashem means the name, period. And that's very easy. Okay? Oh, here we go. Number five. Sometimes I steal my own fire. What is it meant by mentioning God's name in vain? This means mentioning a divine name for no reason at all. However, to mention it in a way of praise or prayer is permitted, of course. There you go. Thank you, Misty, very much. Yeah, that's a very good source. Dictionary.com, thesaurus.com, those I call up. If I have, if I'm writing something, I use thesaurus.com. Even when I teach, if I need to explain something and I don't quite have the word at the tip of my fingers, I will go to thesaurus.com to help explain it, it's a good source. Okay, however, to mention it in a way of praise or prayer is permitted. It is likewise permitted to bless one's friend with God's name, saying, God bless you, and the like. Therefore, one who erred and mentioned God's name for no reason should immediately praise and give honor to him in order that the mentioning of God's name will not be in vain. Got that. A person, this is number 6, I'm on page 271, a person should always honor God's name in any language when one does mention his name. One should think about the reason and purpose for mentioning it in order that it not be mentioned in vain. The sages of blessed memory say, in any place one finds the mention of God's name in vain, one finds poverty and death. Ooh. When one wishes to bless and thank God, one should direct his thoughts and words in order to say words of thanks and praise to honor God's name. In this way, the result will be that the name of God is exalted and not disgraced. We see that Joseph acted this way, where it says, and God was with Joseph, and he was successful. And his master saw that God was with him, and all that he did, God made successful. Rashi... Rashi explains how Joseph's master saw that God was with him. The name of God was fluent in Joseph's mouth. That is to say, he would constantly credit his success to God and publicize his name, as Joseph said to Pharaoh, God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. So again, you'll hear me or you'll hear other Yidden say, God willing, God forbid, God this, and that's not taking the name in vain. That's attributing, good, bad, or otherwise, to a power greater than ourselves. What? What phone? It's Deborah. Or Steve. Oh, okay. Okay, that's cool. All right. I got a bike ride tomorrow morning. Yay! Okay, this is also the way of Abraham to teach all the nations that it is fitting to praise and bless God's name alone, as it says. And there he proclaimed the name of God, God of the universe, meaning that he caused all people he encountered to call, that is to say, pray and praise in the name of the Holy One, blessed be he. And he taught every person to pray to God and praise the name of God. And no, when we write one and all, and you'll see me do this if I send out an email or something on it, when I write God, I don't spell out, I don't put the O in there. I do that one, and actually, well, that's another, I'm not going to go there, it's another story. One who pronounces the explicit name according to its spelling, as written Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, will be uprooted from the world. That's from Tractate Sanhedrin, from Tractate of Avodah Zarah, Rosh on Tractate Yoma, and the Tor or Chaim, chapter 621. That's the citations. When a person reads scriptures containing God's name, it is permitted to read them as spelled in any language, except for the name Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, which is forbidden to pronounce. Rather, one should say Adoshem. Some are even more stringent and do not read God's holy names as spelled even when reading scriptures, but rather substitute Hashem, which literally means a name. That's what I've been saying all evening. It appears that this applies only to God's names written in the original Hebrew, but God's names in other languages are considered like attributive names and may be mentioned while learning. Thus, there is no extra personal merit to honor to God in stopping oneself from pronouncing them as they are translated in other languages. One who curses any person with God's name in any language, whether he curses himself or others, or even a dead or evil person, has transgressed a prohibition since he uses God's name in vain. What I will say, the worst thing I will say about somebody who is in the world's opinion as evil, Yimach Shemo, which is may his name be erased. I won't curse him with one of God's names. So if you hear that, Yimach Shemo, then you have heard someone say may his name be erased, and that's referring to bad people over history or current very unpleasant people in the world. Okay? One who mentions God's name in any language and spits in disgust, whether he does so before or after he mentions the name, has jeopardized his part in the world to come. I'd have to think about that one, Oki. I prefer, if it's a bad person, may his name be erased, which is kind of interesting to have a name erased in the Book of Life. But if it works for you, use it. No. I just have a difficulty attributing the word being blessed with deeds that are wrong. That's my difficulty. May they be blessed according to their deeds is a positive connotation. Even though it's not meant that way in some cases, it's a positive connotation. So what I would consider saying is if it is a truly evil person, and there are some very evil people in the world today, may their names be erased. And without going into detail, there are a few of them out there. And a few people's names who have come up, and I'm sitting there in a discussion and these names of these hideous people pop up, I will say may their names be erased. And over the last decade or so, there's been some people who have gone to the other side, as they say, and I will say may their names be erased. Is that a problem? Told you. Don't worry about color. Erased, yes. Yes. Erased as in the Book of Life, the book that everybody's name gets written in. Erase that dude. Yeah. So as an example, there is a guy by the name of Yasser Arafat, may his name be erased. I have no problem in one foul swoop saying that. May his name be erased. May he burn for a while on a slow spit, any of that stuff, not a problem. So, yeah, but I usually see Yamaha Shimo. Okay. Cock-a-doodle-doo. Yamaha Shimo, yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah, definitely. That soul has been scorched to never come around again. Yeah, that individual there, that soul's been scorched and will not come up any way, shape, or form. That has been separated. Okay. It is forbidden to mention any of the specified holy names, even names for God in other languages, in a place where there is filth or in an undignified situation, since this degrade is degrading to God's name. So here's an interesting one that came up once upon a time, and I don't know, maybe nobody in here has ever come across something like this, but I'd like to say it anyway. You don't read a holy book in the bathroom. If you're doing some sort of blessing, you don't do it around odors that are odoriferous. That's about as... Well, I can't say, you know, somebody who... unpleasant odors. I decided not to use the vernacular on that one. Exactly. And so, odors that are odoriferous, that's a good one. I'm not sure what that means, but it sounds kind of good. Yeah. 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 Okay. The word shalom in Hebrew is also a name of God. I said this an hour ago. As greeting while one is in such a place. This applies specifically to saying it in Hebrew, but is permitted to say the translation of the word shalom in other languages, since it's not considered God's name. One may, however, call a person by his given name shalom in the bathhouse. Yeah, Misty, it says in Tractate Brachos, which is the first tractate in the Gemara, that if you have to go through an alley, a smelly alley, and it's time to say the Shema, and this is the example that's in the Gemara, you have to wait till you leave the alley. If you're davening, if you're praying, and there's an unpleasant smell, and that unpleasant smell is wafting through the room, you're supposed to wait until the smell passes before you continue praying. I read that someone said you shouldn't carry American money into bathrooms because of the motto on it. I'll hold your money. That one's impractical. But Jim, if you need someone to hold your wallet while you're going to the bathroom, give me a call. I had to take the shot. I blot out the little eyes on the pyramids. Maccabee, before you start defacing American currency, you got to find out what all that means before you do. Okay? Because the all-seeing eye is a Masonic thingy, and that's not necessarily a bad thingy. Okay? Not necessarily. No, Maccabee, no, I don't know where you got that, but that's not necessarily true. The all-seeing eye that's floating above the pyramid, and number one, that stands for the unfinished state of the temple. No, I don't know, that's not true. That's not what it was meant to be. The top of the pyramid that is floating above is the unfinished state of the temple. Maccabee, be careful. Maccabee, be careful. Because guess what? My father went through a German Jewish lodge in New York. So guess what? Masons can be sworn in to Masonic lodges on Torah. Of course not, but it is metaphorical. Okay? So, Maccabee, before you go off into those tangents, you might want to take a look at some other areas and ask some other questions. Okay? Yes, dear. Okay, attributive names such as compassionate, the merciful, the faithful, and the like may even be mentioned in Hebrew in a bathhouse, even if one intends that it refers to God, since people are sometimes also described in those terms. Rabbi Dove, the compassionate, the merciful, the faithful. Ooh, I could see that. Well, maybe not in this life. Okay, the last couple, then we get on to the Torah portion. If you don't have it with you already, grab your Stone Edition Chumash and we'll have a discussion about this week's Torah portion. Pinchas. Yes, dear. My first week without a Johnny Bench. No, the water's okay. Thank you. Okay. It is forbidden to destroy holy names in writings, as this is a disgrace and God's honor profanes his name. The Hebrew names which may not be destroyed are the ones that I listed earlier. However, if one only wrote part of the name, such as Shad, or Shekai, or Eh, as in since he does not complete the names, he may erase them. If there is a need to do so, however, it's forbidden to disgrace them. So, if you're typing along on your computer, and this is, let me see if it gets into this. Nah, I got one that's not in the book. Okay, let me get into this in a second. It is even forbidden to erase. All right. 13, one may not disgrace a holy name writing in any language, for example, by putting it in the garbage or an unclean place such as a restroom. And the same applies to all written verses from the Holy Hebrew Bible. If there's a need to dispose of them, one should bury them in a container or conceal them in an earthenware vessel, which is like burial. I would get hold of my local rabbi if you have a chumash that is in the state of disrepair. Likewise, it is forbidden to verbally mention God's name even in prayer in an undignified place. This would disgrace the person's prayer and the name he utters. Now, here's an interesting, is my the end? Yeah, that's the end of Blasphemy chapter 2. We'll hit chapter 3 next week. I'll set this aside. This has come up time and again in my discussions. Let's suppose you're typing along on your computer and you type one of God's name on your computer. And actually the rabbis took about 2.5 years, I think I mentioned this once before, it took about 2.5 years to come up with the answer to this. What about disposal of all of our old Bibles? A couple of things, you can either send them to me. Hang on a second, Maccabee. Stick them on an Avodah Zorah bookshelf somewhere else, or send me an email and we'll take care of that. Because some of those Bibles I can get, I mean, if it's an old family Bible, I wouldn't dispose of that, you know, if it may be a family, but if it's just like a NIV or one of these other ones that you can, little paperback ones that you pick up for a few bucks somewhere, or one of the Gideon people hand one out, or one of your local witnesses hand you one. Jehovah's Witness Bible, I've got no problem tossing that one, because that one is just not really, that one's a mess. But Alan, send me an email and we'll talk about it. How would you just do that by accident? Let's suppose you're typing along, Maccabee, and you are typing and your fingers are flying along, and I type pretty fast, my wife types real fast, and you type out one of God's names. and it's on your computer. So the question is if you can't erase the name, how do you exit out of the program? And the rabbis were asked exactly this question. As computer programs came up, as this came up in computer programs, as an example, the Stone Edition Humish came out on CD-ROM, 10, 15 years ago, and before they corrected it, you open a program and you see Bereshit and it's got God's name. Now they take it and they remove a part of a letter so it's not all there, or they put a space in Havaya, there's a space where the Vav is, etc. But before that, the name would pop up, and somebody called the rabbi and say, look, I got one of God's, this is pretty cool, look at my name, my hand looks like huge. I put this on my computer, God's name's up here, can I exit out of the program? What if the power goes down? Am I high of, am I in trouble for erasing one of God's names? And actually the rabbis asked that question. If I write up here, this name, and then I erase it, did I just commit a sin? And the rabbis talked about this, and this was in the response of, this is a very, very complicated question, and the answer is this. The stuff that you write on here, is it really here? Okay? These are pixels. These are little things of light that are flashing on and off and on and off and on and off. And so actually, if you see this letter that's here, that letter is not, oh, Superman. If you see that, our eye sees it as one solid. You see the name that you type up here, the word backspace that Maccabee wrote. That name is actually not there. It's little pixels that are flashing on and off. And so it's never really there. And so the answer is yes, if you're in a program, you type out God's name, you may erase it because you haven't really put it on there. Isn't that fascinating? So if you wonder where rabbis go and discussions they get into, it's pretty remarkable. Pretty remarkable. Okay, this week's Torah portion. We are in Parsha Pinchas, which is in the book of Bamidbar, which is the book of Numbers. And we're starting on chapter 25, verse 10. Let's go back to chapter 25, verse 1. Now, let's set the stage as to what's going on. Where is it? Bilaam, ow, my cable got stuck in the computer desk here and about pulled my headset off. Okay, let's set the stage. Balak contacted and bribed through flattery, money, everything else, a guy by the name of Balaam to come and... Oh, I did it again. Oh, man. I turned on my... Uh-oh. Hang on a second, one and all. Oh, I got it. Cool. I've got these two buttons on this mouse, and if I hit the button wrong, a big magnifying glass comes up, and it's a little bit on the distracting side because I'm very distractible anyway. So anyway, this guy Balaam has been enticed to curse us. So he gets on his little donkey and he rides his little donkey, and of course his little donkey, God opens the donkey's eyes, which is another way of giving him the ability to see things that we normally couldn't see, and he sees an adversary standing there with a drawn sword, and the little donkey goes over to the side and leans against the wall, and Bilaam beats the poo out of his little donkey, his little she-ass, as it says, and there's that whole discussion. So he goes on, and even though he's warned, he's told in a dream not to do this, he still ends up with Balak, and the two of them go up on this hillside overlooking the children of Israel. We don't know they're up there. he sets up seven altars and he gets these animals and he kills the animals, sacrifices them. Balaam knew the four-letter name of God. He knew the tetragrammaton side of God. God would talk to him. Now, going back, it says earlier in Torah that he was a righteous person, along the lines of Jethro. In fact, he was one of four advisors to Pharaoh as to what they're supposed to do with us. I said that early on in class. And so he is enticed through money, fame, and fortune to come and curse us. And so he sets up these seven altars and brings the animals in, and he goes to town doing what he can, and instead of cursing us, can only praise us. How lovely are your tents, O Jacob, which is the song you sing when you walk into a synagogue, and that's where it came from. That was, instead of his curse, that was his praise, and his boss got mad at him every time he was supposed to curse, he praised. Now, that's what's going up on the hill, and this is one thing that I think is very important to do in Torah study, is a lot of people spend a lot of time in other faiths taking a piece out of Torah, a piece out of the prophets' writings, dump it into another book completely, and prove that the jumbo jack is really a pizza. You know, whatever they do is kind of, I don't understand how they come to the conclusions they come to, but other people take and they slice and dice Torah and they stick their face in the book and they take a look at every single word, which I have done over the years. You go in and you take a look at every word, yeah, and how it's worded and the order of the word and the word substitution and all this little micro looking at Torah portions is fascinating because you learn so much from it. But one thing that people who are new to Torah study need to do, and people who've even done Torah study for a while should do, is let's look at the overall picture. What's happening? You got these two guys up on the hillside building these altars, shechting these animals, and trying to invoke God to do harm to us. We, on the other hand, are camped down the hillside in this big area, and we're oblivious to what's going on up the hill. I don't know why we're oblivious to it, because if I see up on a hillside seven altars with things burning on it, I would kind of say, hey, guys, tailgate party going on up there. So what is happening is we're in the camp, and lo and behold, these women, a barbecue, yeah. Lo and behold, these Midianite women show up in camp. Now, gentlemen, unfortunately, this is one of our weaknesses. If you don't believe me, how many of you have the swimsuit edition of the Sports Illustrated, which I do not, but I'm sure other people might. What? I got a glare on that one. That was a good one. So anyway, along comes these good-looking young ladies. They enter our camp, and they're carrying these little stone statues. And they take these little stone statues and they set them down and they tell the males, hey, I'll tell you what, if you urinate or you poop on that chunk of stone, you can have me. And these guys are going, oh, you got to be kidding me. And of course, they go ahead and they do that. And there are guys who are doing things they shouldn't be doing. Zmiri and Cosby, of course, get together in one of the tents. The Midianite king, who's up in the hill, his daughter is heading towards Moses' tent, but gets intercepted by this one guy, and they're inside the tent doing whatever those two were doing, which they shouldn't have been doing, and along comes this little guy by the name of Pinchas. Pinchas is a lowly person. Pinchas, in some midrashim, his job was to clean out the pens. He was a poop shoveler. His job was to clean out the pens, and I'll tell you what, he was the best pen cleaner outer they ever had. He was zealous in what he did and did it exactly. What did Pinchas do? Pinchas took a javelin, went into the tent, Rand, the male and the female, through what it says is their abdomen, but it was through other parts. And he ran them through in such a way that when he took the javelin out with them on the end and held it up, people knew exactly what the two of them were doing. And of course, that was a form of idolatry. Which, when I really looked at this for the first time, my yarmulke spun on my head a little bit. This is before the days I wore this cool do-rag. And if you think about it, these people are in the wilderness. Everybody we've come in contact with has tried to destroy us, tried to kill us off, tried to assimilate us. And this goes all the way back to Jacob's time when we're sitting outside the town of Shechem. Let our daughters and your daughters married, we'll mingle, have one big happy party. They tried to do that in Egypt, and they're trying to do that here. But what they did here is to get us to be involved, and we went into this early on in the divine code, that even something that to us is as disgusting as either urinating or defecating on a stone, for those people, that was a form of worship. So hence, we were involved in avodah zarah, idolatry. And on top of that, the sexual immorality is secondary to the idolatry. Idolatry is a huge, huge sin. And that is what Pinchas stopped. And if I'm not mistaken, I remember off the top of my head, there's 24,000 people died because of this sin. So in the Midrash says that Pinchas ben Eleazar ben Aaron the Kohen, merits reward for courageously slaying Zimri, who publicly desecrated God's name. So Zimri and Cosby together were doing what they should not have been doing after Zimri participated in idolatry. Pinchas gives them both a run-through and holds them up, stops the plague. Why did God describe Pinchas as the son of Eleazar and the grandson of Aaron? Interesting question on this. This is the beginning of Parsha of Pinchas. After Zimri's death, members of Shimon chided the tribesmen of Levi. We cannot believe that Pinchas is a sincere zealot. Now, don't forget, well, maybe you didn't know this, but don't forget, Zimri was from the tribe of Shimon. Shimon was the tribe that constantly got themselves in trouble. We talked about the box where when we traveled, we talked about this. There was a tribe, 1, 2, 3, animals here, animals here, 4, 5, 6, animals here, 7, 8, 9, animals here, 10, 11, 12. And in the middle were the Kohens and the Levites and the Mishkan and all that. This tribe right here, looks like my bedroom. This tribe right here, if you notice, is boxed in by these two stronger tribes. These up here were the strongest tribes. They march forward. These were strong tribes because they protected the flanks. In the back, and here in the middle, was the tribe of Shimon. Shimon, if you remember in the little thing in Shechem, Shimon and Levi were the two that went in and slaughtered all the men of the town of Shechem. Shimon was a hothead. Shimon was feared by Joseph. Why? Because Joseph remembered what Shimon and Levi did, and God forbid he's going to have Shimon stirring things up. And so what did Joseph do? He put Shimon in prison while the brothers went back to go gather up father. Now, this is putting the entire picture together. Shimon was a tribe that they really had a difficult time with. Zmiri was from that tribe, and here's what he said. Well, that's what the tribe said. How could that deed that Pinchas just did have been for the sake of heaven? Either he assassinated our judge, the head of our tribe, out of hatred, or he was in person, or he was personally insulted when Zmiri challenged Moshe concerning the Midianite wife, since Pinchas himself comes from a Midianite. Interesting question. God therefore instructed Moses, publicly publicize forever that Pinchas is a tzaddik ben tzaddik, a righteous person from a righteous person. His deed was inspired by the same noble motives that inspired the actions of his father Eleazar and his grandfather Aaron. Why did God make a point of mentioning Pinchas' relationship with Aaron? Aaron was outstanding in the performance of kindness in bringing peace. Aaron never uttered a harsh word. Even his rebuke was gentle. Hey, Chesed's here. On the surface, it would appear that Pinchas' act conflicted sharply with his grandfather's philosophy. Surely murder is an indisputably cruel thing to do. God therefore explained that Pinchas actually performed a kindness resembling the merciful deeds of his grandfather Aaron. By slaying Zimri, he rescued the entire people from death at the hands of heaven, for they were all guilty of tolerating evil in their midst. Hence, Pinchas' deed benefited all of Bnei Israel. Okay. We've discussed this in here before. This is an important concept. We Jews, no Jews were involved in the sin of the golden calf. One Jew was killed, the sin of the golden calf. It was all the Arab Rav's doing. They did it. Yet, because we did not stop that which went on, us firstborn lost the priesthood, and to this day, we're blamed for the sin of the golden calf. We weren't even there. We were there, but we didn't stop it. And the same thing here. This went on in the camp with these Midianite women coming in and doing what they were doing. And what they were doing was a sin. One person, this little lowly person, Pinchas, zealously, and in this case, zealous is a positive connotation, zealously went and took care of business, and he did an amazing job, and Moses publicly praised him for it, and he was elevated to the kahuna. Okay, four people were despised because of their lowly origin, and God defended their honor. Pinchas was accused by scoffers because he descended from the former idol worshiper Jethro. God therefore proclaimed he's a worthy descendant of his grandfather Aaron and the founder of his tribe Levi. His forefather Levi wiped out the city of Shechem because he was zealot against immorality. The Kohen Uriah, who officiated the first base of Migdash during the reign of King Ahaz, was suspected by the people of having descended from the Gibeonites. God therefore declared that his origin was pure. 3, the prophet Ezekiel was mocked because he descended from the convert Rechav. Oh, Francis's relative. God therefore distinguished him by stating the word of Hashem came to Ezekiel's son Abuzi the Kohen. And number 4, she is paying attention. I thought she was near the computer. The prophet Jeremiah was also jeered because he was a descendant of Rechav, another relative. The Pusuk therefore makes honorable mention of his descent, stating the words of Jeremiah the son, etc. The Almighty promised Pinchas will reap rewards both in this world and in the next. So in case you guys are wondering where I'm reading from, this is a book called The Midrash Says. and it is wonderful for giving you. I have the Chumash open, and it talks about Bilam's plot. It talks about his zealotry, the attitude towards Midian. A new census is taken, etc. This is from the Stone edition. And this is another census is taken. The census total, 601,730. The count of the Levites. And the grievance of Zelophehad's daughter, which is the next thing I'm going to touch on. Okay? God instructs Moses to attack Midian. The Torah calls someone who causes a Jewish soul to go astray as a murderer and regards his deeds more severely than if he had killed his fellow Jew. And if you wonder what my attitude is towards people who proselytize to Jews, pretty much. Let me say that one more time. The Torah calls someone who causes a Jewish soul to go astray a murderer and regards his deed more severely than if he had actually killed his fellow Jew. If so, how does the Torah view organizations or movements that have alienated untold numbers of Jews from Torah and mitzvahs? I go on, but it going into an area that I'd rather not go into. But anyway, they are considered as having murdered people. The last counting in the wilderness before we went into the land, how the land was distributed, and I'm going to go into Zelophehad's daughters here in a minute, then we'll show the little video and we'll call it a night. Zelophehad's daughters had a request. What book are you in now? The Midrash says, right there. Okay. Zelophehad. Actually, this is, I'm just using this as kind of a guide, but Zelophehad was an interesting person. If we remember back a couple of Torah portions, this man was caught, after being warned repeatedly, was caught collecting sticks on the Shabbos. You don't do that. You don't gather sticks, especially if someone says, hey, you're not supposed to do that. Don't do that. And he kept doing it and kept doing it. Well, guess what? Working on Shabbos is a death penalty. So they put this poor guy to death. Well, Zelophehad had five daughters. And Zelophehad's daughters went to Moses and says, look, our father did something wrong. He was executed. Okay, that we understand what happened. However, is it fair that his portion in the land and his inheritance should go to other family members? What about us? Which is really a good question. Yeah, it is actually 27-1. Thank you, Larry. What about us? And Moses, you know, asked God, says, hey, what are we going to do about this? And God told Moses, told the ladies, hey, you can inherit it. You can inherit from your father. So in here, and this is a Torah discussion that I had with my eldest daughter a number of years ago about inheritance and women. In Jewish thought, women can inherit. Now, unfortunately, around the 8th or 9th century in Europe, once upon a time, there were businesses that if the father had only daughters, the business would pass to the daughters, the whatever would pass to the daughters. Well, unfortunately, and listen carefully to this, because when I first heard this, my mouth swung open. Unfortunately, in Europe, the local community says, hey, women are chattel. Women can't inherit. And they gave the local Jewish community a terrible time. And that's where the status in Europe of the women, because we feared for our lives, the status of women changed in Europe. Yeah. So, in Jewish thought, and we see this in this story, Zelophehad's daughters, that in Jewish thought, and as soon as Moshiach arrives, God willing, all of this will change. Women can inherit. It's not a problem. It's not a problem at all. It would be unscrupulous males who would be otherwise. So, ladies, Jewish thought and these classes are not to ever put you as second-class citizens, God forbid, because by all means, you are not. And if you want to find out any truth in that, anytime ask my wife how I take care of her. You're more than welcome to ask. Okay. Ooh, she's here. What is she typing? Oh, thank you, sweet pea. Adi Ron time, you betcha. Yeah, I do take good care of my wife. So anyway, I want to thank everybody for coming in. Enjoy the music. I've enjoyed this week. Next week, same bat time, same bat channel. Be well. Have a wonderful evening. And you got a question, send me an email. And the person who asked the question about homeschooling, I will get back to you. Night.